Welcome back to the podcast program. It's a Friday edition. I hope you're doing well. And if you come to hear about conference realignment, then yes, we're going to get to that. But not just that, but with the Big East totally melting away. And as we record this podcast late on Thursday night, I mean, who knows, by the time this goes up Friday morning on iTunes, and if you're just getting to this driving home on a Friday night or Saturday, you're walking around a mall and listening to it as you Christmas shop. One, I apologize. I'm sorry you've got to listen to me and Glockner here. But secondarily, there could be any number of headlines that could still come out. So I guess kind of a disclaimer, everything we're going to discuss is things that have been reported and are out there as of midnight heading into Friday, and who knows what we'll have. Andy Glockner from Sports Illustrated, SI.com, is back on the podcast, the original podcast godfather for college hoops, as far as I'm concerned. It is great to have him back on. I had mentioned this before when I had him on last season. You know, back in like 06, 07, I could not get a writing job, which is totally understandable, and so I was a waiter at Applebee's, and I'd go in at like 9:30, 10 in the morning and do what they call back of house prep, and it's where you get all the food ready and, you know, make coffee and iced tea and all that stuff. And normally there's only one or two people in there, and when I'd have to do that, I'd bring in my my iPod and listen to you do the ESPN pods back in the day. So it's always awesome to get you on, man. How you doing? And thanks for coming back.
I'm doing good, and I apologize retrospectively for all the poor salads that were served at that Applebee's, as your chopping was probably disrupted by all the juicy content we had at the time. But it's funny to be on the other side of the table for sure, and you guys do a good job with this.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah, it was. I worked at a few different kind of places. The Applebee's one, actually, people are always kind of like, eh. I worked probably like four or five restaurants between college and afterward. And I was like no huge fan of the food, but it was by far the cleanest restaurant I've ever worked in. And the tips were actually fairly good in regard to some other places. So no regrets. That was my last waiting gig before I was lucky enough to move on and able to write for a living. All right, so let's get to the Big East stuff here. There's so much we can touch on, and it's almost like the league's become the town bike. You know, 17 teams, I think it was, Brett McMurphy, formerly of CBSSports.com, now at ESPN.com, who's done some good work breaking so much conference news. I think he said 17 teams will have left this league within the past decade come through. One of your colleagues, Stuart Mandel, had a tweet that said, you know, 2 years ago, the Big East had 11 teams in the tournament. UConn won the title. And now you look forward 2 years from now, and it might not even exist, and even if it does, it's going to be nothing remotely recognizable. So before we get into specifics, I just want your overall take on what's happening with the Big East. What do you think, you know, I don't think anyone thinks it's good, but what positives do you see from this? Was this ever avoidable to begin with? What's your takeaway, Andy?
Well, I think, you know, it's been a rough day, and you know, the content off of this podcast, what people are writing, is more disposable than any, you know, any napkins or salad remains from that Applebee's. I mean, it's 5 minutes later, it's completely wilted as far as relevance. But, you know, I looked at today, you know, we got involved. I mean, you're a college basketball honk, so am I. We got involved in working for a living in this sport because of our love for the game and our passion for it over our, you know, our infancy as adults, so to speak. And I almost felt like today was the first day in a while where basketball actually stood up for itself. Mm-hmm. And the Big East as we knew it was already gone. You know, you could say the Big East still existed, but, I mean, nobody was in it. I mean, the Big East that we grew up with did not have Tulane, Houston, SMU, you know, East Carolina for football. I mean, it was a joke. It was a brand that was being leveraged to ram other teams into it that were not worthy of that label, at least in terms of basketball. And today, finally, the league, not necessarily the name the Big East, but the league got back to its roots, at least the non-football teams. And I think I'm okay with that. I think I'm okay with the formation of another basketball conference that actually cares about basketball in a landscape where basketball is irrelevant and nobody cares about basketball. So, you know, look, I'm not necessarily say I'm that much more interested in watching Seton Hall and Providence play, you know, whoever they're going to play. And if they take, you know, Dayton, I mean, who's going to watch Providence-Dayton? I mean, that's not really going to be a national, you know, five rating or anything like that. But basketball mattered again today. And with every decision in this landscape being driven by football and television revenues related to football, I think that was my small silver lining today, is we're going to get a pretty good basketball conference out of this.
I agree. I touched on this on the blog on Thursday, and I do like the fact that, you know, the Catholic Seven, some people are calling this, you know, the Big Priest, which is a good name.
I like that. I like the Conference of the Holy Cross. Okay. I like that one too.
it's very good. So I see it from two angles here. One, I very much like the fact that these seven schools said, you know what, enough with this. We are sick of this. We are tired of football ruling the roost and killing us off. There is an alternative side to this, and if you check out Friday's wake-up call, I have a column linked from Jacobs of the Current, who writes pretty well on how we shouldn't be really glorifying the Big East as it's been recently, because, you know, it was destined to do this to itself. And as you point out, listen, there's a lot of crappy programs among this Catholic Seven. I mean, it's kind of like DePaul's just kind of like, hey guys, we're cool. Like, he's like the straggler. DePaul's like the straggler of the group. Like, you know, in high school or college, you tended to do things on Friday nights or whatever, and there always be that one random person. That's DePaul. Like, DePaul's still in the mix with this, and it's like, dude, get out of here. But regardless,
it's all about footprint, man, and theoretically, yeah, they're part of Chicago's market, so they have value.
Their
program has not been relevant, although they've won five games in a row.
I know. Look
they
out,
went down
right?
To Arizona State and hammered the Sun Devils this week. So, I mean, you know, who are we to say that maybe they can't be on the bounce? But I think the bigger picture here, though, is, like you were saying, the Big East has become a fraudulent proxy of itself. It's not the league that we grew up with. It doesn't have any of the tradition. It doesn't have any of the history. You know, the names have been shuffled. The sport, you know, they tried to bastardize it for football. It didn't work. They weren't savvy enough to pull any of that off. But in a bigger picture here, I mean, we're going to have to accept a reality of two things. One is leagues are not as we knew them. And two, leagues are completely fluid. And none of this is safe unless at some point Jim Delaney and maybe Mike Slive decide to put the ego wars down and stop. Mm-hmm. Because there's too much money to chase. There's too much instability. There's too much TV influence. I mean, look, I half suggested on Twitter today that, look, do I really think ESPN is orchestrating all of this behind the scenes? No, I'm not that cynical. I don't necessarily think that, nor do I have information for that. But it certainly benefits ESPN to, A, have this basketball conference pop up that'll be cheap inventory for them in the winter if they choose to acquire the rights for it. And you have to believe the Catholic schools had some sort of an understanding that there's going to be a television contract for them in order to make this move. I think that's just a reasonable assumption, even though that's not been reported yet. And two, you know, the weakness of the Big East from a football conference standpoint means there's less desirable inventory for any possible competitor of ESPN. So there are so many moving parts here that are yet to be sorted out. And then, okay, well, what happens with the ACC? Are they going to get poached again? Is somebody else going to go to the SEC? Is the Big 12 going to wake up and say, we don't want just 10 teams right now? Is Larry Scott sitting here, you know, twiddling his thumbs and saying, hey, just wait till we, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to go after Texas and Oklahoma again, whatever it may be. You know, the point is that, you know, we're looking at this from a basketball standpoint, but the bigger picture is going to continue to dictate things. And my fear, honestly, is, A, they're going to go after Atlantic 10 and maybe Creighton from the Missouri Valley. So those two conferences are going to be potentially impacted. And then the bigger picture here is, what does the Big East do? Because you still have a Boise State and San Diego State headache where you're trying to hold on to them. Is the alternative there, and I think Dan Wolkin on Twitter also mentioned this today, do you go for a kind of a two-conference East-West all-sports conference and raid the Mountain West? Yeah. Do you go and get UNLV? Do you go and get New Mexico? Do you go get Air Force if you think they're viable, or San Jose State? Create a whole Western division of this Big East, the new one, you know, I think in an all sports way, that could be a viable league, and it would be a pretty good basketball league if you pick the right teams. So, you know, to say this is going to be over, it's never going to be over until somebody steps in, some adult steps in and basically says, enough is enough. We're all making millions and tens of millions of dollars, and we've bastardized the landscape to the point where it's almost unrecognizable. And hopefully the damage from that is not too much to overcome.
Yes, the possibilities splinter infinitesimally. Okay, there's just the idea of a, you know, bi-coastal league is intriguing, but we'll put that, it's actually really intriguing. But I'll put that to the side for now. I'm curious about the remaining members in the Big East, what happens there, because, you know, the Big 12, I don't know what it's going to do. It is interesting that it's just quietly, like, cool with it, with 10 programs. When, if you talk to people connected in the ACC, they'll tell you that FSU, Georgia Tech, Clemson, like, all those programs kind of, like, desperate to get out of the league. And if they do, then does that mean Cincy and UConn ultimately go to the ACC?
Right.
Because they're just kind of just chilling there.
You mentioned Cincinnati and UConn, who, in my mind, especially UConn, but both of those programs are by a significant magnitude, the biggest losers in all of this right now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, UConn, I mean, you're still in Connecticut. I spent 9 years there. We're familiar with the landscape there. You know, they don't represent a desirable TV market. But the school, you know, whatever you want to think of Jim Calhoun and the allegations as far as Nate Miles and all that kind of stuff, I mean, that's a micro issue. I'm talking macro issue for UConn. They were a national title winning basketball program that took a fledgling football program and a terrible on-campus stadium and turned it into a BCS-level, BCS bowl-attending football team with a nice stadium, you know, in East Hartford. They put everything that they needed to build that athletics program to win this type of a realignment game, and they still got screwed. They're completely hosed right now. So, you know, when you're looking at what they're trying to do, and it's interesting to get Jacobs' perspective because, you know, he's right in the midst of this at the Hartford Current. I don't know what UConn is going to do other than to beg for an invitation somewhere. And that invitation might have to wait to come from the ACC when somebody else ejects and goes to another league. You know, the Big 12, they signed away their second and third tier rights into kind of that group pool. So you think there's stability there, at least for, what is it, 5 more years or whatever the term of that agreement was. Mm-hmm. And right now they're getting so much BCS or now playoff money. You know, McMurphy's article the other day said that they're going to get, what, $90 million to split 10 ways, not 14,
yes,
from the playoff. It's a financial boon. And, you know, Texas is sticking around because they're getting the extra $15 million a year from ESPN for the Longhorn Network. So, you know, it's just a shame. I mean, we've spent, what, 15 minutes now talking about, like, balance sheets, finance,
and that's like
SMU and Tulane as Big East teams. I mean, it's astonishing what has happened in the last couple of years. But it really is a bigger picture that, you know, this happened in the early 90s when the, you know, the ACC raided the Big East at that point and it started all this.
Yeah, and I totally get, and we won't get deep into the lawsuits and the money that's going where, because I know listeners and readers can get lost. You get so many figures tossed at your face, you almost become, it becomes white noise. It is astonishing though. Andy, the moving parts here and the lawsuits and what money's going where and where it's coming from is gargantuan. For football primarily, but even when you deal with basketball, and you mentioned before, you know, the Catholic Seven, you got to figure they've got a decent amount of intel that indicates to them that it, you know, if they start this new league, they're gonna have a good TV contract from it. For anyone listening and wanting a timeline, we can't give one, but you know, ESPN.com reported late Thursday that this could be, you know, a 27-month waiting period.
There's no way that'll
happen. Exactly.
Yeah,
I find that hard to believe.
Negotiated out, you know, like every other exit fee has been. But there's so many, like you said, there's so many issues here. I mean, you'd have to believe there's at least some understanding of the value of this conference from a TV standpoint. They had to have vetted this with somebody.
Right.
You know, so then you have the lawsuits dealing the exit fees, the brand name, the Big East. Apparently now they can't dissolve the conference because they need 2 football members to vote with them, and that's not going to happen. So these schools will have to leave. So now they're leaving the NCAA tournament units, the Big East, you know, earned what, $24 million in tournament units last year, something like that, over the six-year rolling period. You know, do they get any aspect of that money? I mean, there are going to be so many lawsuits filed here, and then other lawsuits involving exit fees paid by teams, let's say like Memphis or so, you know, whoever had to get out of their other conferences to get into the Big East. There's so many layers of complexity here from a legal standpoint that, that there's no way anybody can give an accurate time frame at this point.
Yeah, and listen, you know, on a certain level, it's depressing. I mean, I grew up on the Big East. You know, Rob Dosser at NBCSports.com said something about this Thursday. You know, he also actually coincidentally grew up in Connecticut, and that's so much of how I grew to love the sport, just because I actually, you know, I grew up in Vermont, and a lot of that stuff, I don't know, you know, it was just what I identified with. I followed other conferences, but the Big East, you know, Big Monday, these are things that still...
I mean, I grew up on Long Island, and I was 12 in 1985. I mean, I was an enormous St. John's and Chris Mullen and Walter Berry fan, and, you know, Georgetown with Patrick Ewing was the enemy, and, you know, and you know, Syracuse obviously was relevant then. He got into the late 80s with their talent that they had there, and it just, you know, we just have to accept that what used to be is no longer. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. We're still going to get some really good games.
Yes.
But it's going to be in just very awkward, weird, cross-regional, not quite fitting, you know, and you'll just have to accept it as, you know, all right, I'm going to watch the game on the court, and I'm not going to worry about why Maryland is playing at Iowa City on a Tuesday night, because it makes no sense.
Right. While the particles of the sport will still be the same, there'll just be elements and threads that we really enjoyed that are all but obliterated now. And one last thing before we get away from the Big East stuff, because on Monday's podcast, we're going to be talking about it again, so I don't want to take up all this stuff here. But, okay, so you suggested, I am totally in agreeance, that this new league, Catholic 7+3, should go to 10 so you can do an 18-game round-robin schedule. I totally agree. So let's just say that's what they do. What three teams – two questions. What three teams do you want, and what three teams do you think they'll get in a hypothetical if they settled on 10?
Well, I think the two teams that I would go after would probably be Creighton and Xavier. Now, it's, you know, it depends. Creighton and the Missouri Valley have a bond. Doug Elgin told me when I was doing a story on Wichita State a little bit ago that they're the only conference other than the Ivy League that has not changed membership since 1995.
Great stat.
Yeah, there's a significant commitment from these schools to the Missouri Valley and the membership there, even though some of the schools are private and some of them are public schools. So it's not like it's all the same type of academic mission or the same type of university in there, but they're all committed in the same way, and they all value basketball as a way to market their universities. That said, Creighton, a lot of people don't realize this. Creighton, I believe, was number 6 in Division I in attendance last year. Yeah, they draw 16, 17,000 a night at a pro-style arena in Omaha. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a terrific program. So if I'm looking at, you know, getting a splash and getting a relevant program, I'm looking at them, and I'm looking at Xavier, which, you know, you don't have to go into how good Xavier has been over the years. And you know, the same thing there. Big attendance, good arena, good fan base, good program, NCAA tournament wins, you know, the whole lot. You know, and then I guess a lot of the buzz is about Butler and taking the Indianapolis market and, you know, how well that program has established itself. You know, does Dayton get left out in the cold? Does St. Louis get left out in the cold if that's the case? There are a couple other ways you could go about doing it. But I think if you're creating a basketball conference sort of against what's best for you profits-wise, then you should create a basketball conference that's best for you basketball-wise. And I think creating a 10-team league with an 18-game league schedule and every team plays home and home would be awesome. I think that would be a great selling point for whatever you want to call this new league.
Yeah, and if they got, I'll say they don't get Creighton, but if they got Xavier, Dayton, and I'll say St. Louis, I'll say they won't get Butler. But if you just give it, you know, Xavier, Dayton, St. Louis, in my opinion, you do that plus the 7 that are going, big picture over a 10-year span, I think that's an average 4 bid league a year, and that's awesome. Like, I think that's legitimate with Marquette and Georgetown, and you'll have cycles of years where Providence might have a 2-3 year stretch where they're going to be, you know, decent, mm-hmm. and other teams go up and down. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's got some quality for sure. It'll be like a sort of a good year in the Atlantic 10 where everybody's like, oh, I could get five bids, and then they end up getting three because you sort of, you know, eat your own in the league play. But, you know, when we're talking about this, you know, the new kind of basketball conference real quick, and I know you don't want to belabor this, but think again about that bi-coastal potential 12 or 14 team Big East where you're going to have Memphis. You will have UConn right now. You have Cincinnati right now. You have Temple right now. You would be adding San Diego State. You would be adding potentially New Mexico. You would be adding UNLV. Like, that's a great basketball conference.
Oh, yeah.
By accident. You know, if you wanted to do it that way. And then you could keep, you know, seven teams out west and have them play most of their football games out there. And then, you know, have a couple of road games where you have to travel. It wouldn't be that bad.
That would be truly innovative. And if it happened, I'd be surprised. I would welcome it in a hypocritical way because I early on, like everyone else, I just kind of like cracked jokes and bitched about the total, you know, just dismissal of geography as any means of putting together an actual league. And at this point, it just doesn't matter. All right. I want to hit on a few things here that, that Andy's written about. You brought up Krzyzewski and whether he's going to ultimately retire with a record that's, near unbreakable. You want to set up your piece and the premise of it?
Sure. We were doing some stuff on coaches, and I did a column today on Larry Eustace and how he was settling in. And it dawned on me when I was doing the piece on Larry, who has well over 400 wins, I believe, at this point in his career. I mean, 400 wins in college is a terrific college career. I mean, Larry Eustace has been around for almost two decades coaching. And he's going to end up like 600 wins behind Krzyzewski. Yeah. I mean, it's insane what to think about the accomplishment of Mike Krzyzewski is. Whatever you think about him, whatever you think about Duke, when I was crunching the numbers, Duke has averaged over 30 wins a season for the last 15 years.
Stupid.
Every year they're winning 30 games. Now, you could say whatever you want. I've banged on them hard about their NCAA tournament record and how they earn seeds and then don't live up to them. They have a very bad performance against seed expectation the last 10 years, other than the one title that they won in 2010, where Duke people think I hate them because I mentioned how soft their draw was for three rounds. But it's amazing the consistency with which they win. And combine that with the fact that he started in an era where he got a job at 28 and then built this Duke program up and basically has had the run of the run of the campus for, you know, ever since they became nationally relevant. It's just a situation that seems almost like one of, nobody's going to win 500 games again in baseball. Nobody's going to pitch 470 innings in a season. It's a different sport now. So when you look at the potential for anybody to catch Mike Krzyzewski, you're talking about 35 seasons of 30 wins.
Right.
That's what you're going to need to do. And, it's virtually impossible, although, maybe Bill Self does have an outside shot at it if he decides to stay. Maybe Billy Donovan will grind till he's 75 and get there. I mean, there are a couple of possibilities, but it's one of those records that I think we're going to look back on afterward. And we talk about the Big East and how everything's changed. This golden generation of coaches is just about over, too. Jim Boeheim's going to leave eventually, and Mike Krzyzewski will retire eventually, and then we'll really have lost everybody from sort of the era that we grew up rooting for college basketball.
I think Boeheim goes before Krzyzewski. If that didn't happen and Boeheim was just like the ultimate lifer, then he could obviously pass him because Boeheim's...
Yes. He's Boeheim's, what, 30, 35 wins behind, something like that.
Yeah, he's at 890.
He would be within range if he felt like sticking it out.
Yeah, he's at 898 right now.
I have a suspicion that Krzyzewski would have an interest in maybe lingering another year or two if necessary.
Hey, I don't doubt that at all. I do think there is a chance if guys like you mentioned Shaka and Brad, because they're so young and they've won a lot, and the sport is affording more chances for more victories in a year. It's still hard as hell to win 30. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And you mentioned Bill Self. I mean, what Bill Self's doing at Kansas is also, it's just like people sometimes they just don't appreciate, like, yeah, you're at Kansas. There's no guarantee. Look at Gillespie at Kentucky. Look at Doherty at Carolina. There is no, look how things have turned on Howland at UCLA. There is no guarantee that you're at a blue bud. That means you're making Sweet 16s annually. You're finishing top two in the conference and just strolling to 28 wins. It does not work like that. And it is unbelievable.
Unless you're Bill Self, who has won his league 12 of the last 14
Amazing.
Years and is regularly minting 32 win seasons now at Kansas. You know, I mean, he's as sure a thing right now as there is in college basketball.
It's unbelievable.
There's any argument about that. There's no dip. He's got this thing humming. He hasn't had necessarily, you know, premier talent on some of these teams, and he's still cranking out Big 12 championship teams that are winning 30 games. So if there's ever going to be a guy that basically you can count on to just clock it every year at 30-5 or whatever they're going to end up being, you know, I would bet on Self. It's just a question of how long he wants to do it and whether the NBA ever comes calling for him.
Last year was the prime example because prior to the season, I remember kind of doing prep work, maybe even doing a podcast with Goodman and Parrish, and we were discussing the imminent—I mean, just idiocy in retrospect. The imminent down season for Kansas. You know, would they even be good enough for an 8 seed? And what happens? They go to the damn title game. I mean, it's just nuts.
We should learn not to doubt certain things. Although maybe you know what? Maybe we all got sucked into the vortex of Calipari this year, and we just assumed he'd be able to make magic out of out of freshman again. And hey, who knows? Maybe they will still figure it out. But
we'll see.
You know, I might have fallen prey to that trap as well. So you never know quite what to believe every year. But I think if there's one thing to believe, I think you have to at this point believe in Bill Self. I think his track record basically explains that to you.
Hey, on your Eustachy piece, you know, you live out there in Denver now, so it's what is that, like a 20-minute drive out to Fort Collins? How far is that?
It's actually farther. It's about 60 miles north of
Denver. Oh, okay. All right, so it's like
you can go like 120 on the highway.
Exactly.
So it's, you know, like you said, it's about 20.
Yeah, so it's like me driving to Hartford, so to speak.
No, it's about an hour 15 from my house.
Okay, good deal. Now, and you basically write that the story with Eustachy is no longer that he's, you know, beating alcoholism, because it's been, and I understand, and I'm totally sensitive to the fact that you never really truly beat it. It's a daily struggle and fight. I get that. But from a college hoops perspective, you tied a nice little bow and said, okay, listen, let's, you know, with Eustachy stories going forward here, let's recognize the man, the coach. He does, as you said, have more than 400 wins. And while it's still a daily battle, that's not his story anymore, right?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting that a story like his continues to be played out in the media and, you know, sobriety, and he's been sober for 10 years, and now all he does is drink like 15 cans of Diet Coke a day to, you know, compensate for the need to drink other beverages. But, you know, the point is there have been other scandals involving coaches that have much bigger names, you know, than Eustachy, much more recently than him. One of them would rhyme with Matino. You know, that kind of thing, that much more sordid, much more tawdry, but yet nobody really talks about that. I mean, maybe you'll see an occasional Twitter joke or anything like that, but nobody really brings that up when they're talking about Rick Pitino's coaching legacy at this point. And when you're talking about basketball, nor really should you. So why should, you know, this incident where, you know, obviously it was embarrassing for him. The photos were embarrassing. Losing your job at Iowa State is embarrassing. You have to then battle addiction. And you, like you said, you have to battle addiction every day. I have a couple of relatives who struggle with alcoholism, and it never ends. You have never escaped from it. You always have to be on guard for this, you know, however long you've been sober, and you do your best every day to get past it. But you know, the guy is an accomplished basketball coach. He's been a head basketball coach now at 5 different schools. He's been good everywhere he's went. He's made an Elite Eight. I mean, how many coaches can say they have 400 wins and an Elite Eight on their resume? And I think 10 years later, you just have to be like, all right, well, what's he doing now? And that was sort of what I wanted to try to discover from him. Sit down, and he said, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, I really want to know anything other than about your path to sobriety.
Yeah, that's
and good. And I think he appreciated that, and he opened up a little bit about, you know, the distance and how hard it is with, you know, inheriting a team with seniors that have had some success and changing approach and, you know, keeping them at an arm's length because you can't make it real personal at this point because you just don't have the time. You basically just have to whip them for 6 months, hope it pans out, and then you can worry about being friends later. And I think that type of stuff gets lost sometimes in the, you know, conferences change, coaches change jobs all the time. You know, the kids get left. A kid like Colton Iverson, who transferred from Minnesota, sat out last year at Colorado State to play for Tim Miles, and now his last season he's playing for a different coach he didn't even get recruited by.
Yep.
I mean, it's just, it's very, very odd on the student athletes at times. And I hope the story today told a little bit of both of those stories.
All right, we're 1 month into the season here, more than 1 month officially now. And we can, you know, get to the exit of this podcast by having you kind of wax on a few things that have stood out. You know, if you don't follow Andy on Twitter, do so at your own caution and discretion. He's at Andy Glockner. He's a good follow. He dishes out a lot of stuff. Funny guy, a lot of facts. But sometimes it's just a total Twitter bomb, and I'm like, oh God, here it comes. I can just sense it. Here comes another one. But
it's kind of sprinklerish.
It is. Oh, you know what? That's a great way of putting it.
The water faucet is off. Yeah. And then there might be a stream of consciousness, and sometimes it's college basketball, and sometimes it's soccer, and sometimes it's Rob Parker saying really, really dumb crap on national TV.
Yeah, I refuse to address that on this podcast. So let's go hoop stuff here, and give me impressions, good or bad, and anything you want to do, man. Coach, player, team, conference, you know, two or three things that have stood out to you, things that intrigue you going, you know, heading into 2013 as we look ahead. What's on your mind, man?
I think the ACC intrigues me. I think we thought it was going to be pretty bad at the bottom, and I think it is pretty bad at the bottom. I think we all sort of held our breath on trying to come to terms with NC State being the favorite in that league, because you looked around and you were like, really? Mm-hmm. That's the team we have to pick? We have to rely on Mark Gottfried and a bunch of freshmen who have never really done this before? And all of a sudden Duke pops up and their young guards play way better than expected. And Mason Plumlee's a national title, you know, national player of the year candidate, and Ryan Kelly's playing well. And suddenly Duke looks like a prohibitive favorite in that league. I don't even think it's really arguable at this point. I think NC State is finding itself, but I can't imagine anybody that was asked to pick the ACC at this point would pick any team other than Duke. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair assessment. And, you know, North Carolina is kind of what we thought they were going to be. I'm not buying into James Michael McAdoo as this front court force that will deliver regularly against good competition. Their guards are, you know, the freshman guard is finding himself. They have a bunch of wing shooters. They don't score well unless they can crash the offensive glass. It's a team that's still trying to find its identity, and I'm sure they'll rise up a couple of times in league play and pick somebody off, but I don't think they have the horses to win the ACC this year. So I think you're looking at Duke, and then Duke's going to be a one seed again, and everybody's going to be angry about it.
Yeah, but they're going to, this time, I mean, they're proving nice and early that they've got the resume to warrant that, because they look really impressive. What about the Big Ten? Considered the best league overall, it's got four teams in the KenPom top 10. Minnesota, shockingly, you know, only from, because you wouldn't think. I mean, they're 11-1 and worthy to be there. But I mean, might the Big Ten actually be even better than we expect it to be? Or maybe is it just it's not as good near the bottom? And so, you know, while it might be the best league, it's truly not as good, 1 through 12, as we might have hoped.
No, I think it probably is a little better than we thought it was going to be. I think Indiana, despite a pretty suspect non-conference schedule, has looked good against that schedule. So you don't really know what they're going to have, but I think we can assume they're going to be a very, very good basketball team that will win a lot of Big Ten league games. I think Michigan is better than I expected them to be.
They look really good.
The transition for Glenn Robinson and the addition of Nick Stauskas to really solve some of their perimeter woes and give them the flexibility. I think somebody mentioned this today. Was it Luke Wynn who was talking about how they got away from playing zone? They don't play very much zone anymore.
Yeah, he mentioned it in his power rankings.
Personnel actually go out and guard people now, so mm-hmm. they don't have to junk it up. So it's, you know, it's sort of this myth of what they're doing, but it's a different team this year and a very good team. I saw them. Were you at the NIT semis as well?
I was at the NIT finals.
Right. That's right. You were there that week, right?
Yeah, I was there. The finals. I was there the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Okay. All right. So I ran to Borzello and Goodman and all the rest.
I'm sorry.
The semis, and we saw Michigan, and they looked like an excellent basketball team. Michigan State, I think, is still going to be pretty good. I don't think they're going to be great, but they're going to be good. Wisconsin's a little bit down because of their point guard problem. Illinois, obviously, is better than a lot of people thought they were going to be. But as I wrote on Tuesday, I'm a little wary about this footprint they're creating there. They're not the New York Knicks. They're not going to ride 43% three-point shooting and, you know, a hailstorm of perimeter jumpers to consistent wins in the Big Ten. They're going to have to mellow that out a little bit, get to the line a little bit more, get some more easy baskets around the rim, and they'll probably adjust. You know, John Gross is obviously enjoying playing with guys that are a little bit higher talent than maybe he had at Ohio overall. And the rest of the league, you know, they're pretty good teams throughout. I think Penn State's going to suffer without Tim Frazier. I think that's really disappointing for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, even teams like Northwestern and, you know, Purdue will be okay. I think the league is going to be very difficult. They're not going to be very many easy nights for anybody other than potentially if you get Penn State on your home floor. And they're going to get probably, what, six bids, maybe seven?
Yeah, I think... I think probably 7, but we'll see. And well, when will you start? For you know, for those listening, if you're unaware, you know, Glockner has done bubble watches. Geez, man, is it a decade now between SI and ESPN.com? When do you start actually?
This is 9 years now.
Yeah. 9 years. When do you seriously start looking at resumes? Yes, we are bringing up Bubble Watch on December 14th, but I'm just wondering.
No, it's funny. Joe Lunardi is a good buddy of mine, and he's always been very generous about when I moved to SI. He didn't really care that I started adding bracket stuff to my Bubble Watch because we used to write complimentary pieces, and now I'm quasi-competitor of his. I mean, it's not like he cares. But, you know, I've kidded him in the past because he just came out with a 100-team S-curve
I saw
this
that.
Week.
Oh, God.
I was like, Joe, it's December 10th, man. Like, you know, everybody's 7-1. Like, how do you differentiate between all this? So I believe our official launch this year on SI.com is January 8th. I think we're getting past the New Year's and we're going to have the
good
bracket and bubble watch out that day. And, you know, even at that point,
it's still early.
People love talking about
they
this.
Do.
It's a page views generator. It's got everything you want from internet content. It's disposable. It has lists and it creates arguments across 100 teams. It's fantastic. It's internet nirvana, but it really doesn't really competitively mean much until maybe mid-February.
Totally agree. Too early, but people, I mean, listen, they read and react to it, and so that's why you get asked to do it. Your colleague Andy Staples says it all the time. He's like, I hate doing power rankings, but you idiots keep reading it, so I'm going to do it.
The one thing you can start to see, though, especially as non-conference play ends and the major conferences have sort of locked in their positioning vis-a-vis non-conference RPI performance, I think what you start to can pick up is trends. You could start to look at, okay, like a week into the season, we knew that the CAA was going to be a one-bid league. They killed themselves. Drexel was horrible. Delaware blew its opportunity. Old Dominion's been horrendous, and that's the end of it. I mean, you don't have to think anymore. The CAA is a one-bid league. There's no doubt about it. You know, you look at things like that, and you look at the way, like, a Conference USA or a Missouri Valley, I mean, could they now benefit from that? Is that possibly a three-bid league if Wichita State, I know they lost tonight, but if they continue to win and Creighton continues to be as good as they are, could a mystery champion slip in as a third team, or is Illinois State good enough to do that? So I think you could pick up some macro trends on the way the bids are going to be allocated. But beyond that, I mean, teams will shuffle in and out of those spots based on what they do in conference play.
You're going to a game on Saturday, aren't you? And you're hanging with Goodman. Is this can we clear up the rumors here, man?
I am hanging with Jeff Goodman at his alma mater, Arizona. You know, when I first saw this on the schedule, and I'm like you said, I'm out in Denver, and I it's like a $100 flight to get down to Phoenix, and then I'm driving down to Tucson. I'm like, all right, it's cheap. I'll go. Like at the time, I just thought it was just going to be like another game and an excuse to see a team that like we hadn't really talked about on SI at least. We haven't really covered Arizona yet, and Florida, you know, I've seen, but I haven't seen in person. I'm like, all right, it'll be a neat game to go to. Nobody else will be there. Now, all of a sudden, it's the game of December.
Yeah, it really
is. Nothing else going on. It's a top, you know, 5-7 or whatever it is in the polls, and two really, I mean, Florida looks tremendous. I mean, you want to talk, we talked about, you know, the Big Ten and ACC. I certainly didn't have it. Did you have Florida looking like clearly the best team in the SEC?
Not even close. And to my own admission, on the site and on the pod a couple of times, I have been particularly skeptical of Florida in the past 3 or 4 years. And to a certain extent, it's small sample size, but it's come back to bite me with two Elite Eights here in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I don't worry about the NCAA tournament
right,
as much, but they look legitimate this year in a weird way because, I need to figure this out because I've seen them on TV, but not a ton. Is the influence of a bigger pass-first point guard like Scotty Wilbeck in that much of a calming influence on both ends of the court where they're defending better, they can play the zone, and similar to Syracuse, they're now bigger this year, so maybe the zone is more effective, so they're going to it more than twice as much as they did last year. And they're really riding two guys, I mean, Kenny Boynton and Mike Rosario, that are you know, gunner prototypes. I mean, they just shoot. But they've leveled out, and I wrote about this on Tuesday, they've leveled out their shot distribution. They're not so heavily into three-point versus two-point, and they get to the line more. So it's a more, you know, easy game to integrate into the rest of what they're doing. And then you mix in Yegede and Patrick Young inside, and what you're getting is a very balanced offense and a defense that's basically just throttling everybody they've played. It's remarkable. So I'm really excited to see them come out and play at Arizona, and I think Arizona is going to face a really big challenge because their point guard question is the big question for them.
All right, but the big question here is, are you going to go head-to-toe with Goodman here? I mean, sharing the hotel room, right?
Oh, so. Head to toe. I mean, whatever. I mean, whatever he writes, I'm sure my stuff will be better. That's fine. And, you know, I know Goodman is super popular down in Tucson. That's what all the locals tell me down there, that he's, like, a very, very popular person down there.
Yeah.
So, basically, I've gotten threats, and, you know, people are like, man, I wouldn't go hang out with Goodman in public. People hate him down here.
Yeah.
I said, well, that's the safest place to be. If I'm standing right next to him, I'm not going to get swung at. That's great. Plus, Goodman's, like, 19 inches taller than I am.
I
think I'll be fine with Jeff. I could probably survive a day in Tucson. He's going to show me the very best Taco Bells that he used to go to.
Oh, God.
You know, get the best of the Mexican cuisine down in southern Arizona, and I'm going to enjoy the weekend.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I look forward to the dispatch there with you and him. That'll be something. I think he really enjoys just kind of staying up all night watching some hotel cable. So enjoy the trip there with him, and I'm sure he'll somehow throw slander your way on the Wednesday podcast. So I'll do my best to defend you. But
well, I'll listen to that, and then I'll decide how much of FoxSoccer.tv I'm listening for.
Exactly. There you go. All right, man. Hey, listen. Thank you so much for coming back on. Have a safe flight. Enjoy the game. Have a good holiday season. And as we get closer, you know, toward that mid-February timeline, we'll get you back on to talk some tournament.
Sounds good, man. Take it easy.